Hello and welcome to the Armenian News Network Grung Week in Review. First, Happy New Year to our listeners and followers. We wish you all a healthy and prosperous year. I'm Aspet Bedrosyan, and along with Hovig Manucharyan, this week we're going to talk about the following major topics: the state of the opposition and their demands, an update on the border positions between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and the state of the line of contact around Artsakh.
And to talk about these issues, we have with us Aspet Kochikyan, who is an associate professor of political science and international relations at the American University of Armenia, where he teaches courses on post-Soviet space and the Middle East. Congratulations, Aspet. And George Tabakyan, who is the co-founder of Repat Armenia Foundation and Sahman NGO, and executive director of RR Foundation, which works mainly on projects with the Ministry of Defense in Armenia. Hello and welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Hi, Hovi. Hi, everyone.
Okay, so we have a few topics this week to discuss. Let's start with the continuing situation in the internal political areas. So the state of the opposition and their demands. The Homeland Salvation Movement has been demonstrating for the past 2 months, demanding the Prime Minister's resignation. And yesterday, the leadership of the movement, Vazgen Manukyan specifically, and Ishkan Sagatelyan and Artur Vanessian, met with the Foreign Minister Aray Vazyan. I'm interested to know if there's any outcome from the meeting that we can talk about. You know, one thing I just caught before the start of this podcast was that Ishkan Sagatelyan announced that their meetings with the Director of National Security and Chief of General Staff did not happen. There are also claims that because of this, they're concerned about what's being planned, and their doubts essentially were magnified. So maybe we can start with Aspet Kochikyan. What do you think happened in this meeting, and what can you tell us about this?
Well, I can't tell you much about it because I wasn't at the meeting and no one is. And actually, I find these meetings quite interesting in terms of the reading the statements afterward from each side as to what has been said or what hasn't been said actually is more telling than anything else. Combining what you said about the proposed meeting with the director of the National Security Services as well as the chief of general staff, actually there were reports that the opposition, especially Sagatelyan, who seems to be the main spokesperson of the opposition, has expressed disappointment that they didn't respond to the opposition's request to meet with them. And then, on the other hand, they praised Foreign Minister Aray Vazyan for meeting with them. I think there is a sense of panic or a sense of deep concern in Armenia and in various Armenian political circles about going to be having the talks starting tomorrow in Moscow. And they are either trying to get reassurances that some of these issues are not going to be special issues related to border and the implementation or the realization of the November 10 agreement, as well as getting any information from official channels, which up until this point has been quite lacking.
Yes. What I found interesting from the announcements also was that the warning that any agreement that is counter to the interests of the Armenian people will be rejected and will not be ratified and so forth and so on. But, you know, I'm not seeing any people on the streets, and I'm not seeing any major resistance other than verbal posturing and warnings. So, you know, a lot of people in who support the opposition still are expressing dissatisfaction and expressing a resignation with the opposition as well, because if this is such a huge issue of, you know, and there's treason that is being planned and so forth, why isn't the opposition more vocal and more loud on the streets? And essentially, is this all they can muster? George, maybe, I don't know if you can talk about this.
Well, regarding the meeting which is scheduled tomorrow, I mean, there is a lot of unknowns there, and the media has been full with a lot of rumors, information. Even the agenda of the meeting was out. I mean, we saw a couple of versions. So honestly speaking, nobody knows what will happen tomorrow. What I heard from my sources that this is exactly what the Minister of Foreign Affairs told the opposition yesterday, that there is no agenda and we don't know what they will discuss tomorrow. One thing is clear is that there are works going on the border in Ararat and in Tavush. There are meetings happening. And most probably it will be the demarcation process which happened in Sunik. It will be continued there.
Well, we can talk about that actually as the next topic. Would it be correct to say that the opposition, not knowing what's going to happen, is basically saying proceed at your own risk rather than trying to stop the thing from happening in the first place?
There are actually two dimensions about the Moscow meeting, I think. One is internal, the other one is external. Externally, I think Armenia does not have any sort of independent, autonomous, sovereign sort of decision-making, or the minimal when it comes to whatever negotiation is going to happen. If anything positive is going to come out of this for Armenia, and I use the term positive there loosely, it would be most probably because Russia wants that to happen. And secondly, in terms of the number of opposition's stand on and reaction to all of this, I think they also understand that things are out of Armenia's hand. And it doesn't matter what Pashinyan nor the foreign minister Ivazian will be talking about. Rather, at the end of the day, it is the fate, not sealed, but at least determined in Moscow, determined by Putin himself. So I think that is the wait and see policy. And in the absence of any concrete action, as well as any concrete or increasing number of street protesters or street presence, I think it is more prudent for the opposition, as they're doing, to just limit themselves to statements, political statements, which can be any textbook, most of which are classic textbook statements about this and that.
Asped, it seems like the government is not particularly keeping the opposition in the loop. The communication is very weak. Do you have any idea if other parliamentary parties are being kept in the loop, or is there any discussion of what's going on in the parliament?
Asped, I would have to say that I would argue with one of the premises of your question. Is the government aware of what's happening itself? I think, again, all indicators are that this is a very passive government, at least on this issue. At least that's the image that's being projected. But there are absolutely no extra parliamentary or extra my step conversations or consultations going on. I think when it comes to this, just like with what happened with November 10th agreement, is that the government has been keeping their cards close to their chest. That's assuming that there are clear plan of action. So the lack of communication and articulation might be attributed to also the fact that they themselves don't know what they're facing or the magnitude of what they're facing.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know which is worse, them not knowing what's going to happen or them not knowing and not telling people. Yeah, any other questions or comments on this before we move on?
Well, the problem, Hovig, is that when you don't communicate these issues and agendas, it just basically fuels all the rumors and the conspiracy theories. It just cannot be good to communicate so little to the rest of the population.
Yeah, and just before this meeting, when we were discussing this, if you're interested to read Mane Gevorkian's announcement on what's going to be talked about, you should go into the edit history of that post because it's available, and you can see different versions that she edited, and maybe that'll give you a clue as to how messed up this process of communications is even further.
There's one more thing I think it's worth mentioning, and maybe George, and I would like to hear your opinion as well, but in the last couple of weeks, there was a statement that was published by a group of civil society organizations with a roadmap for the next 3 to 6 months. It's a comprehensive, quite interesting document. It's a sort of an amalgam of various civil society organizations that they came up with, and it's well written. Now, the content is another thing, but it's if anyone has a chance. I read it twice. It is generic. I don't know. Anyone familiar with that statement or came across with that statement?
Aspet, the problem is that since the November 9th, there has been a lot of things happening in Armenia, in the diaspora. A lot of organizations, the church has been taking stances, but the government or the prime minister in particular is going with his plan.
No, this civil society is not about the, I mean, this is the same thing. I wanted to put it in the context of the opposition, because we have Holik earlier asked about what is the opposition doing or not doing. And it was interesting for me to juxtapose this with what the civil, that group came up with. It's not just one group saying that we need to do this and that. It was actually, it has elements of demarcation and alienation, border issue. It has issue of, creating a militia. Basically for security purposes and so on. I think there might be also providing an alternative to opposition, but without a politicized opposition, if you want to call it. I just wanted to bring that out. If no one has seen it, I think it's worth exploring and see if it will carry a lot of momentum or any momentum down the line.
Yeah, civil society is also a very loose term. Do you know who is the leading force behind that statement?
It was actually, as I said, they were on HETC. They had a statement. One can check on they had a meeting on December 18th. And again, it was almost two dozen various civil society organizations who were basically involved in this. They were quite critical, actually, in terms of the content. They were quite critical of the government. They did even ask for creation of commissions to identify cases of treason, which is being thrown out left, right, and center. The issue, as I said, of security, be that the militia, but as well as the army. It's about the accountability. It's about the issue of the border demarcation. It's also about bringing back the issue, the Minsk group, which actually is quite interesting because that coincides also with some of the statements made by the opposition, Vaske Manukyan and others, about bringing back the Minsk group. So I don't know if this is a way to depolarize the existing polarization, or it's just another, as George mentioned, another sort of drop in the ocean.
Okay, if we can find the statement, we will share it with our listeners in the podcast notes. So the next thing I wanted to discuss is the update on the border positions between Armenia and Azerbaijan. I've been careful to not use the word demarcation because, you know, it's not clear whether that's what's happening. So we've heard a lot in the past months that Armenia and Azerbaijan are busy negotiating their border. Mostly it seems to be unilateral concessions, but anyway, an international border has never been recognized. And, you know, you can go to our past podcasts, numerous podcasts that we've had, where we discussed this. But, you know, we need to cover this again because there's some news. So while Nikol Pashinyan has denied that the process currently taking place is an official demarcation or delineation, which are legal or specific terms about recognizing borders, since our last podcast, the Armenian press is filled with reports about loss of territories, especially in Shurnukh and Vorotan. And even the Armenian ombudsman's stepped in and warned that against the use of tools and methodologies which have been resulting in inconsistent results and also undesirable outcomes. Earlier this week, we heard that the Armenian NSS chief, Abazian, apparently held an unannounced meeting with his Azeri counterpart on the border of Armenia and Nakhichevan. At the same time, there are various news reports that the fate of Tigranashen or Kyarki village was discussed, even though I'm not sure if that information is official. So, George, what was the outcome of that meeting? Do we know anything? And I believe we discussed Tigranashen during our last video podcast on the border demarcation process. So what do you have to tell us about this?
Okay, first of all, it's important to say that now it's very clear. If last time we were only speculating, now it's very clear that the Armenian government has accepted the last Soviet admin borders, the last, which was in the 80s. The way everything happened in Sunik, the way that the map is being used, we know that this is the map that they are using, although they never announced that this is the map. They just said that we needed a map, we needed a basis, so we're using that map without saying the year. But the way Shurnukh was divided, the way the Azerbaijani forces are today next to the Rapan airport, the way the road near Vorodan was cut off, the 3 kilometers, and the way the 21-kilometer road between David Beg and Goris was divided, it's very clear that they are using the last map. Now, again, we discussed last time that if this is the map which they are using, so they are definitely go to Ararat region and Davos region. Nothing official yet on those two areas, but there are a lot of rumors within the population there. I have a lot of contacts in those two regions, and people are talking already. It's been 10 days. But again, nothing official. Until yesterday, there was leak news, and then NSS confirmed that there was a meeting on the border between the head of NSS of Armenia and Azerbaijan. The meeting was at the border with Nakhichevan, and it was about, and the reason was very weird: the missing in action and the POWs. Today there was another announcement that there will be no meeting in Davos, but they are meeting in Goris again for the same purpose. Now, if we think logically and if we try to analyze this very logically, why the head of the NSS of Azerbaijan has to fly to all the way to Nakhichevan, then come to the border with Nakhichevan to meet the head of the NSS of Armenia, when they could have met very easily in Artsakh or in Ghazakh or in Aykebar, in Tavush, which is much easier for communication. And I trust this 100% that all these meetings are regarding the border. So whatever we said last time, unfortunately, is going to come true. We're talking about handing over Tigranashen, which is an enclave in Ararat region, right on the border with Nakhichevan. It is around 3 kilometers away from Nakhichevan. So most probably this area will be handed over. We will lose a 4.6 kilometer of main road, which links Yerask village to Areni village. This is our main road going to Vayotsor, Sunik, and Artsakh. And most probably the Armenian side will give up some military posts on the border to give a corridor from Nakhichevan to this Tikranashen village, because it's like 3 kilometers away. The same will happen in Tavush. There are two enclaves on the main road, on two main roads, and most probably those will be handed over. Again, nothing official, but the way we are seeing these meetings, and every time it's about the missing in action and the POWs and some affairs like today they announced, I'm fully convinced actually that this is about all the border.
George, even though they are saying that the agenda of these meetings are about POWs, you think that they are actually about borders?
I mean, yeah. Why they need to go to Nakhichevan to discuss the same thing that they can do in Goris and then fly back to Tavush? I mean, this is basically, I mean, the way I can imagine it is the head of NSS, the head of NSS of Armenia meeting with the head of NSS of Azerbaijan on Nakhichevan, along with military commanders from both sides, agreeing where are the points, where is the new border, agreeing which military posts should be removed, and agreeing how the mechanism will work with our armed forces. So this is like a technical meeting, a field meeting where the work has to be organized from both sides, because both sides have agreed, except that neither the population of this village nor the rest of Armenia knows what's going on.
And this is exactly, by the way, what George is talking about. This is the demarcation process, where they actually, people from both sides on any border would meet and decide on a physical aspect of the border and posts and geographical and topographical landmarks, after which they will actually end up having the delineation. But I agree with George's perspective that if it was supposed to be just about POWs and other military issues that they could have met in Moscow under the as a side meeting with the leaders of both countries.
Aspet Kochikyan, though, I understand what you said, but how do we explain then what Nikol Pashinyan said in an interview to Petros Ghazaryan on Armenian public TV in late December, where he said this is neither demarcation nor delineation? If it's neither of those, then what exactly is it?
Well, I think it's both demarcation and delineation. I think it is the initial things. Now see, the problem is at the beginning of any kind of a border drawing between two countries. And again, we talked about this with George in a previous podcast video meeting. You know, they have to have first an agreement. There should be a treaty. Okay, it all starts like the universe started with a big bang. All of these issues, border issues, starts with a treaty where two countries agree, sign a treaty saying that our border should be determined, and in it they put the parameters on based on what would the demarcation delineation be. The next step would be, obviously, as we said, demarcation delineation and so on and so forth. I cannot read Prime Minister's mind. I don't know what is he why he said that, what he said. But this is clearly, and also George also mentioned, I mean, it's all based on speculation. We're seeing that, you know, if it walks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, then it must be a duck. So these are all elements of demarcation, delineation, border agreements, and so on and so forth. So, you know, you and me and the Prime Minister and the opposition and everyone can, you know, scream until they turn blue in the face. But, you know, the reality is that this is, you know, de facto border demarcation and delineation.
Okay.
Let me add also following that. Now, since we know exactly that there is a map and there is the basis of the, I mean, this map is used as a base for the demarcation. If both countries have agreed on it, which is very clear what happened in Sunik and what will happen in the coming week in the other regions, so Armenia can easily recognize the Azerbaijani, or both countries can recognize each other's independence, along with the borders that they have marked in the past 10 weeks. Very simply, this can happen even in an hour, because there are no more issues. We have accepted that this is the map we're using, so there will be no issues anymore to discuss. There might be some places where the border is a bit tricky. They can solve it at the spot, but what we have seen is that it's always against our interest what's going on.
We always ask the question on what basis this is happening. And I think on the same interview that I talked about, Pashinyan said that, you know, Armenia pulling troops out of different regions is not based on the November 9 agreement, but on a verbal agreement. So, you know, this brings up a lot of questions. When did these verbal discussions happen? Is Pashinyan even allowed to do this under Armenian law? As far as I know, either the constitution or there's some law that maybe the law on the borders of Armenia specifically, as it's called, spells out exactly how the Armenian border can be changed. So how can this happen? I just don't know. Like, if this process is illegal, and then it won't be ratified by the National Assembly, and it won't be accepted by the Armenian people. So as far as I can tell, everything that is being done right now is outside of the legal sphere. So even if Pashinyan government goes and says, yes, this is the border, and yes, we're gonna agree, but then parliament does not recognize this, or the Supreme Court, or the Constitutional Court then sort of doesn't recognize this, aren't we just sort of setting up ourselves for more pain down the line?
Well, I would agree, Hovik, with the last part, that more pain is yet to come. But I think when in terms of the issue of legality or not, I don't think that this is outside of the realm of legality yet. Meaning, you know, the leader of a country can have discussions, can have verbal agreements here and there. Obviously, at the end of the day, to ratify or to legalize that, it has to go through whatever the country's mechanism, constitutional mechanism is. As you pointed out, because it's an international agreement, obviously borders and other issues, it has to be ratified by the National Assembly as well as by the Constitutional Court to make sure that it doesn't contradict the Constitution itself. So I don't think that as of now, any verbal agreement or any verbal communication would be the outside of the legal norm. It would be bad, probably, but it's not going to be legal. The legality or the illegality is when, for instance, there will be an agreement signed and ratified on the spot in Moscow.
Except that if you're not recognizing the borders, then aren't you bound to protect them until you recognize them? But we're essentially, like, you know, just the act of ceding and allowing the Azerbaijani army to come in and occupy posts without any legal basis for that. Just sort of verbal discussions and unratified documents.
Now, see, that's one of the interesting things. It's the sum of small illegalities, if you want to call it, or sum of small cases here and there that eventually end up creating the whole border. As also George mentioned, that you have a micro level here, a couple of kilometers here, a couple of border clarifications here and there, and so on and so forth. And then voila, at the end, you already have the demarcation and the delineation done and completed. And, you know, you're faced with the reality to deal with it. That I agree. Yeah, that's the direction that we seem to be going.
Let me add one thing from my side. I believe this border issue and the map as the basis, I think it was part of the 9th November agreement. And the reason I'm saying that, we have a couple of cases, and I'll mention one specific case, which I knew personally about, when the Azerbaijani soldier has approached the Armenian volunteers in Shurnukh village, and they said, these neighborhood or these 11 houses are ours and we have agreed on. And the reply from the Armenian side was, no, we're not aware of this, so we're not leaving. And then after one day, some officials come from Yerevan saying, you know what, we have agreed on this. So even the people, you know, standing on the border, be that regular army or the volunteers, they were not aware of this until the last moment. But we see that the Azerbaijani soldier was aware of this, and whatever they said, it was true. So there was an agreement. It was oral or whatever, it's not important, but it was agreed on, and I believe it was done on the 9th of November.
In all of this process, I think it's would be quite interesting to find out, and again, the devil is in details, but also information is in details, if you would see Azerbaijani soldiers and military arriving in Armenian side, going and meeting them. Are there components of engineers there, or are they just military? Are they, you know, do they have measuring devices? Do they have other things? You know, in a way, by basically observing, if they have it, then obviously this is de facto a border demarcation and the delineation and so on and so forth. Or is it basically people sitting in Moscow or in Baku or in Yerevan deciding on this without actually doing anything on the ground? So I think one has to keep an open eye on these, and not that it would make any difference, but actually it would make us better understand if this is actually being demarked, border demarcation or delineation or not.
Well, Aspetjan, both sides, they have GPS equipment. Along with the Russians, they also have GPS equipment. These equipment all over the world are the same. And when we don't see any objection from any side, which means that everybody is okay with that. So both sides, they bring their own maps, which are the Soviet maps, which are the same maps, but basically. Right. And they have the GPS. In some places where there were small issues and they were quickly resolved because of, you know, the maps are old. Back then, maybe there were a lot of construction or like new houses. No, not coordinates. There were coordinates, but there were like new houses right. built. Which were very close. Like in Shurnuk, there is a house which is like halved right now. So half of it is on the Armenian side and the other half is right. Azerbaijani side.
Actually, I was thinking about that. Historically, maybe the village was in the area that it was, but over the last 30 years, it expanded. And as it expanded, it actually crossed into, quote unquote, the boundary of the other side, of the Azerbaijani side.
This is what exactly happened, actually. There were 11 houses yeah. in the 80s there. And some guy had built his house and it was like expanded most probably. So with these new coordinates, it was halved. Even we have a similar case in the mountainous region of Kharkunik region, which is between Vartenis and Jermuk in that area.
Right.
You know, we don't have houses there. There are no buildings. But there was a single room there, which was exactly at the border. And apparently the Azerbaijanis came first and they put their flag. They said, this is ours. And then the Armenians.
Did they put it inside the room or outside on the house?
No, it's on the house, actually. It's a small house. It's like in the mountains, you know, people can rest there or whatever. There is nothing there.
Okay.
So they called on the Russians and they came with their own maps. And it turned out that that room is completely within our admin border, so they asked the Azerbaijanis to leave and they left. So as you can see, I mean, there are no issues.
Yeah, George, things like these happen, especially when you have new borders being drawn and new countries created and so on. I'm not saying that this is the case now, but it also depends on the relationship between the two countries that are dividing the border, right? When Ukraine yeah. and Belarus or Belarus and Poland decided to draw their border, they had an amiable relation. But now every single detail, every single house or every single room in a house, if it's past the border or not, is going to become a point of contestation.
But unfortunately, you know, there is usually there is some logic in this demarcation. Like if a house is halved, usually they say, okay, keep it in the Armenian side and then we'll give you another area somewhere else. So
exactly.
But this never happened, actually. So no. We are following exactly the border, which is mentioned in these admin maps of the Soviet Union.
George, with all the exclaves being demarked and delineated and some of them being conceded and stuff, how sustainable is this going to leave the overall republic itself? For example, communications between central Armenia and Sunik, what with the concession of, 3 kilometers around Vorodan, etc.?
Well, I mean, if we take what's happening right now, I mean, I'm going to Sunik next week just to try it on myself, but I know a lot of people have done that. So this 3 kilometers that you pass before you start, that you enter that zone, so you have welcome to Azerbaijan, that sign. So you have our NSS people advising people to drive carefully and not drive when it's dark or at late night, or just drive quickly to pass that 3 kilometers, because anything can happen. And they have this hotline number saying that if something happens, call us on this number. And something means, you know, stopped by an Azerbaijani checkpoint. Or a petrol or whatever. The solution will be building a new road. I mean, this road cannot be used regularly. I mean, imagine a family passing it at night or whatever. Anything can happen.
Is the road a mountainous space?
Yes, it's a mountainous space. Some part of it is within the forest, so it's a jungle there.
So it would be fairly difficult to reroute that.
Well, highway. I mean, they have to build a new one. There is an old road which goes through Datev. It goes down to Dugapan. So most probably they have to fix that road and, you know, asphalt it so it's usable. Now imagine the same thing happening in Dikranashen, which is a big enclave.
Right, that was my next question.
It's a big enclave with that village. This means that the main road going from Yerask towards Areni, you know, it's also a mountainous road. So this will be either the Azerbaijanis will say, okay, you can use it, but we monitor it and it will be very dangerous. Or they say, you know what, we're blocking it, so you have to use another road from, you have to open another road through the mountains. And the problem with that will be, it's near Dikranashen. We have other two Armenian villages. One of them is Baruysevag, whose water comes from Dikranashen. I can guarantee that the second day of this handing over, the water will be blocked. And this village, Baruysevag, will be in front of another problem. So these are many questions that, especially when we are talking about the enclaves, there are a lot of questions what will happen. In 1994, I was told that the issue of the enclave was again solved with an unwritten agreement. But on both sides, they said, okay, whatever you have on your side, which is Arzovashen, you keep it. And whatever we have on our side, we keep it. And the subject was closed. But there is nothing written on this. So now it's the first time we're talking
about
it.
So that would have been like an all-for-all about exclaves.
Yeah. But now I highly doubt that will be the case.
Okay, let's move on to Artsakh now and discuss a similar situation there. So while Armenia seems to be ceding more and more land to Azerbaijan, much of it in Armenia proper, there is no clarity around the new line of contact around Artsakh, even with the Russian peacekeepers being deployed, as we saw, for instance, in Hintagher and Khatzabert. Meanwhile, Azerbaijan has been applying all possible pressure to isolate Artsakh and demonstrating political and military muscle. For instance, last week's visit to Stepanakert by Armenian Foreign Minister Ara Evazian provoked a harsh response from Aliyev, and Azerbaijan has been obstructing the movement of Armenian forces between Armenia and Artsakh. Yet we're not hearing anything about the rights of Artsakh and the post-November 9 borders being secure. So what is the future of Artsakh's borders? Are we essentially completely at the mercy of Russian peacekeepers and Azerbaijan on how violent or strong the pressure will be on our side?
Let's see first of all what happened in Khatzabert and Hintagher very briefly, because it was like on the news for a week. It was very clear that the Russian peacekeepers said, we're not going there. From day one, they had told that we are not going there. So from day one, they were mobilized. You know, their mobilization was very quick. In 2 days, their army was all over the place. But their peacekeepers never went into these two villages. And we always had Artsakh's defense forces there. Until when the Azerbaijani soldiers came and said, you know what, these two are ours. We have agreed with your government, this is ours. And then that clash happened, and we had like 60 prisoners of war there, and they took over these two areas. The rest of Artsakh's line of contact, let's say, I would call it a border right now, because we have troops on both sides. It has been quiet so far. We haven't heard anything major. But what was surprising was when the first group of soldiers, they were given vacation in the beginning of December to see their families, and they were supposed to come back so that the second group goes. The first group was gone, but they never came back. They were never allowed to come back. The reason was officially there was nothing, but there were the families talking about it. So one of the reasons was the Russians, they didn't allow it. The second was that the Azerbaijanis, they said, no, you're not allowed to send soldiers anymore. Now we know for sure that Armenia is not allowed to send soldiers anymore. So people can leave, soldiers can leave, but they cannot go back. Now, again, the same question arises. Was this decided on the 9th of November, or it was like a new condition brought by the Azerbaijanis? Honestly, I don't have an answer for that. This happened before Ara Ivazian's visit to Artsakh. The first group, which was, I think they came back on, they were sent back in the mid of December, because in the first week of December, they went on their vacation. So I think mid of December, they went back and they were not allowed. This is also one of the things which is not clear. One question is, will there be an Artsakh defense force there? One. Second, if there will be one, will they allow soldiers coming from Armenia to serve there? These both are unknowns, because we all know that the Russian peacekeepers, as much as they are not peacekeepers, they are regular soldiers, they cannot keep the security there, because this is a huge line of contact. This is like a circle, like a peninsula, you know, with a corridor to Goris. So this is also opens a set of questions which we don't have the answer yet.
If I may continue on George's comments and make some informed, I hope informed, speculations. I think there are a couple of things about the situation on the line of contact in Artsakh that is different than defining the borders between Armenia and Azerbaijan. First of all, it is a line of contact. It is a war area. And in that, the Russian peacekeeping forces, again, peacekeepers are soldiers. So just because they are called peacekeepers doesn't mean they're carrying flowers or anything. But from a Russian perspective and for their task, to be more effectively conducted. I think that's why we see some of the border changes or line of contact changes. Some villages returned, or Armenians returning to some villages, and some villages returning or taking even by Azerbaijan, even though the November 9 agreement says that the line of contact is where the two armies are or the two sides are. So I think to a large extent, this is driven by Russians. The Russian leaders or military leaders on the ground, just from the sake of or from the perspective of military vantage or military efficiency. So in order for them to make sure that they can efficiently safeguard and monitor the border, obviously they need to give some land back and take some land on the Armenian side and so on and so forth. That's one. I mean, again, it's highly complicated. We're not sure what's going to be happening. Now, on the other side, also, Hovik, you mentioned about Aliyev making major grand statements about this and that, about not allowing Armenian officials visiting Artsakh and so on. One thing we have to realize, and many people seem to have forgotten or have turned a deaf ear to, is that Azerbaijani propaganda machine, which has been quite active even since July of this year, and more so during the war, is still active. And I think to a large extent, Aliyev is feeding into that propaganda in terms of putting the Armenian side constantly on the defensive. Be that, you know, they managed to get the military supremacy or the win, the politically, they're doing the same thing, and informationally, they're doing the same thing as well. So I wouldn't be surprised. I wasn't surprised at all with those statements. I mean, he did similar statements in the past as well, but they weren't backed up by the fact that Azerbaijan actually managed to win a war with or without help. Doesn't matter. I'm not talking about that in terms of the reality. So I think the situation in Karabakh, in Artsakh, is mostly determined by the Russian military experts and military leaders on the ground.
Let me continue on what Aspet says. Armenia is not a player anymore in Artsakh. Let's make it clear.
Absolutely.
Even in our official statements, Artsakh is hardly mentioned, what's going on. And even to take it worse, when Khizapert and Hintagher clashes happened,
right.
The spokeswoman of the Prime Minister, Mane Gevorkyan, said that we are waiting for the Russians to say, because this is under their jurisdiction now. So they clearly said that we're not anymore the security guarantor of Artsakh. Now, back to Aliyev and what Aspet says, I fully agree with you, but also let's keep in mind that Aliyev also has an internal audience. He has to cater that. As much as Armenians are not happy with the situation, there is a group of Azerbaijanis which are not happy with the situation as well,
mm-hmm.
because they are saying, okay, we won the war, but we cannot go to Shushi. We won the war, but the Armenians are still in Artsakh. And not only the Armenians, now they have their old allies, the Russians, are also there. We won the war, but we're not allowed to do everything we want. So there are a lot of questions within the Azerbaijani society. And what Aliyev does is not only talking to us, but he's also talking to the local population with his high rhetoric.
Of course. Yeah, this is actually right, George. I mean, in terms of the mood overall, yes, there is a mood of victory and so on. But again, you cannot satisfy everyone, right? There are extreme right and extreme left. You know, people who felt that this was not enough, they shouldn't have stopped. You have nationalists who are very much concerned about Russian presence in Azerbaijan, in Karabakh. And surprisingly, and not a lot of people have been talking about this or realized this, but in many various conversations and statements, there are people who are also unhappy or are concerned about Turkish presence in Azerbaijan. Not a lot, but there are people who have reservations. So I don't think that Aliyev has easy hand now or easy path now with all these complications, whereas in the past he had to deal only with Armenia. Now he has to deal with Russia, with Turkey, as well as even further, while this victory has solidified his rule and challengers, anyone who would challenge his authoritarian rule, some people will still use that. They would say, you know what, the war is over. You brought back at least most of Karabakh. So, you know, you should pay attention to democracy now. Because for 30 years, Azerbaijan's, the Aliyev family actually has used the war and the excuse of war to limit any kind of freedoms and democracy and so on and so forth. So that's partially lifted. So that's why we see the rhetoric, consumption for the local press or for the local consumption, but also to make sure that he's the strong person that he is.
Okay, that's all we have for this week. I want to thank our guests and thank our listeners and talk to you next week.
Thank you, Hovik. Thank you, Aspet. Thank you, George.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. That concludes our program for this Week in Review episode, recorded on Sunday, January 10th, 2021. We hope it has helped your understanding of some of the issues from the previous week. We look forward to your feedback and your suggestions for issues to cover in greater depth. Contact us on our website at grung.org or on our Facebook page, ANN-Grung, or in our Facebook group, Grung-Armenian News Network. Special thanks to Laura Osborne for providing the music for our podcast. On behalf of everyone in this episode, we wish you a good week. Don't forget to subscribe to our channels, like our pages, and follow us on social media. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.